Wow. As always, a rockin' fantastic show from Rockabilly Paddy Guthrie. Before we start, let's put the kettle on and listen to The Circling Fin.
In this week's episode of The Circling Fin, Finn Keegan puts the togs on and goes swimming with Beatrix and the Venetians.
When I was little, a beloved relative gave me a valuable ceramic dish, showing scenes from the animal tales of Beatrix Potter around the rim. It must have cost a pretty shilling to buy, and was immediately put away in a locked pantry, safe from little fingers and clumsy hands. I didn't see it again until I was in my 30s, and a parent myself, and the dish was produced, to be put away where my own little ones couldn't get their hands on it. But what is the point of a dish ringed by scampering bunny rabbits if children can't use it for their chicken noodle soup? What is the point, indeed, of those first edition books whose pages have never been cut open, and thus whose words were never read, not even once? What is the point of the flexi-disc singles now 40 or 50 years old and stalked by collectors, whose grooves have never once been run through by a stylus and whose music has never been heard? The point, it seems, is to stop Father Time in his tracks. There's no pause button on the bathroom mirror, but you can at least try to stop him chipping and breaking and wearing down your most precious things. Seal them up and lock them away, just as the ancient Egyptians did with their pharaohs and royal dead, and you might dodge, or might well think you've dodged, time's tireless bullet. But how about taking the opposite approach, letting the wind and rain take their toll, taking out our treasures into the open air? In the grounds of our children's school there lies a whalebone the size of a sofa, left on a grassy bank for children to sit upon, on those historic occasions when the sun comes out. Not so long ago, certainly when I was a kid, the rule would have been to lock such a remarkable object away, if not behind glass, at least behind a ceremonial rope. How much better it is to let children clamber over and interact with this natural artifact, smoothing it out with their hands and feet, just as the ocean smooths out the shards of a broken bottle. If we could afford to, we probably would put the ancient and marvelous city of Venice behind glass or ceremonial rope, unlike the Ukrainian city of Pripyat, not far from Chernobyl, and consequently abandoned overnight. Venice is being emptied more slowly, with the population of the old city halving in the last 30 years. Woody Allen once asked after the Venetian streetwalker, if you hadn't heard, she drowned. But in fact, the whole population is going the same way. It is practically impossible to keep the place afloat, and winter on winter the Adriatic flooding becomes more extensive and deeper. Once the seat of an imperial power with thousands of ships at its command, Venice now is a practically unrunnable settlement, its palazzi being undone by the inexorable rise of damp and rot, its emergency services permanently astray in a warren of streets and canals that even GPS systems cannot help with. And the city's mother nation, Italy, too financially stretched to offer the requisite assistance to keep the city afloat. And so, in the end, we have to resign ourselves to losing what we would normally consider precious, just like Atlantis and Pripyat and the abandoned villages of Akkal. You cannot keep even the glories of human achievement alive if people are unable to keep daily life going in them. There is no pantry big enough to lock Venice away in, no dry dock sufficient for the dehumidifying of the centuries. So, fetch out that Beatrix Potter bowl. We're having old Father Time over for dinner, and as usual, he'll eat all before him. You've been listening to an episode of The Circling Fin. Find out more and let me know your thoughts at thecirclingfin.com.
And if you enjoyed that little visit to the world of Finn Keegan, you'll be glad to know it will be repeated tomorrow on the Sunday Blues and More show with Daphne Mooney from 11 a.m. here on WRFM 98.2. And of course, lots more from FinnKeeganOfSixpence.com next weekend on your community broadcaster when he goes to war with the Bookburners.
Today on The Wired Willow, I bring to you the African Connection. It's now Wired Willow time, so find a nice comfy chair to enjoy that cuppa and let's get to know each other. Today in the African Connection, I bring you Nelson Mandela, because yesterday marked the first ever International Nelson Mandela Day. Now there's someone that needs no introduction from me. Yesterday would have been his 96th birthday, and he died sadly under the political farce of the current corrupt government. But I don't want to talk about that. I would like to tell you of my personal experience living at the end of the apartheid era. In tribute to Mandela and his philosophy of peace, forgiveness and equality for all mankind. Please do not be offended by the terms I use in my telling of the story, because in order to keep the authenticity of the story, I need to tell it like it was, and those are the phrases and terms we used. I only just heard of this piece of music via Liam Corbett, and I would like to play it in honor of the late, great Nelson Mandela. It's called Dry Your Tears Africa by Johnny Williams. But I also dedicate this song in reflection of the sad passing of Lord Altamont. A moment of tribute to two great men. Yourself, Mandela wasn't always a squeaky clean saint. He was born from royal Xhosa bloodline, and they are a peaceful tribe. And therefore, Mandela initially involved himself in organizing non-violent protests. But he soon realized that the Afrikaners showed no empathy. So he had to necessitate another strategy. He became involved and helped strategize some deadly sabotage assaults, much like your Omaha bombings. In fact, he organized more than one sabotage assault. Mandela and his group aimed to attack the infrastructure of the South African regime. The attacks were on non-civilian targets like power stations and railway lines and other important infrastructures. If human lives were affected, it was unintentional. There were incidents of ANC bombings and even confirmed poisoning of water towers supplying fresh water exclusively to white areas. And although those incidents were never proved to be directly related to Nelson Mandela, my Afrikaans friends and colleagues refer to it often, and they always believed strongly he, Nelson Mandela, was behind it. The media on this side of the world never covered the violent attacks from the ANC. And so you never got to hear of the devastation and fear created by Winnie Mandela under her husband's name, which caused even more separation between black and white people. I'm sure the Irish know exactly how to relate to these underhand tactics, because your history is full of examples of unnecessary Protestant and Catholic conflict. Thankfully, for me growing up in the heartland of the white supremacy territory, Mandela was released and he went back to his original philosophy of peace, forgiveness and equality for all. Do you know that I grew up in close proximity to the home of the leader of the AWB? My city was in the old Transvaal, near the border of the Orange Free State, which was where Eugene Tiblange lived. Now, the AWB leader, Eugene Tiblange, is a man you may never have heard of, or, if you have, you've forgotten about. But Eugene Tiblange was a powerful speaker, and I remember him well. He was known to be rude and arrogant. He was a big bear of a fellow with thin white hair and a white beard. He used to sit on a horse and talk to the crowds in random places all around my home city of Klerksdorp. Even in the heart of my anti-apartheid fighting era, I would attend these meetings, just to hear what was happening. I remember being stuck near the front of an impromptu gathering one time and thinking to myself, hey, this is what Hitler must have sounded like. Because Mr. Tiblange was skilled in people psychology, and the horse was to give the illusion of power, and would make this big-bellied man look even bigger. And so the crowds in the back could see and hear him. He would shout in a loud, slow, gruff voice, starting off everything with a question like, do we want our land to be taken from us? Do we want our purity to be broken? To which the crowds would shout their answer in unison. And of course, then they would believe anything he said after that. On those occasions when Mr. Tiblange was due a visit in, and rumors would spread that he would be making an appearance somewhere, nobody really knew where and where he would be giving his talks. Sometimes it was a planned political event in a stadium and people would pay to hear him talk. But mostly you never knew where, even though you would be aware, because of all of a sudden, everywhere you looked in the city and suburbs, you saw a sea of men, women, and children dressed in the AWB uniform. Perfectly ironed safari shirts, safari shorts, and safari-colored knee-length socks. A bit like when Mayo is playing in the finals and the county is wearing its colors and flags with pride. Sorry to make that association. I just wanted you to get an idea of the pride of the people at the time. I did not mean to insult or offend you. Well, the AWB sticker, sewn on the sleeves or pockets of these uniforms, looked a bit like an upside-down swastika. Which, by the way, they did not see it like that at all. And if you mentioned it to him, they would get really upset. To them, the 777 was not evil. It was the symbol of heaven, 777, as opposed to the Antichrist, 666. The AWB stood for the Afrikaner Weerstandbeweging, roughly translated as the Afrikaner Protection Movement. They hoped to claim an area of South Africa for themselves and call it the Free State. Part of that area they wanted was the province of Transvaal. The Free State, called the Orange Free State, already existed. Klerksdorp and my hometown and Rustenburg, further north, were the big cities in that area. They had a powerful following, and they used propaganda to fool the white people. Almost everybody I knew belonged to this group. Okay, I have to make it clear that my father was a racist, but he did not belong to this group. Ah, man, it would take me all day to tell you about the ignorance of my fellow white friends and family. I had constant arguments with them about stupid things like, the black man is an ape who lost its hair and started walking, and eventually they learned to talk. But he's still a black like a gorilla, and therefore he's definitely an ape. Yet, these are the same people who deny the existence of evolution. They would say things like, the black man cannot be human. He has a thicker skull than us. Oh yeah? I would say, so is Mozart. They are animals. Look how fast they run. Look at their stamina. Only animals. Yeah, well, can you believe it? But that was true. These were only some of the ridiculous statements they believed to be fact. It would be insulting on air to mention all the stupid things these educated adults would believe in. It would shock you. I can tell you truthfully that I used to go to bed at night and think about the constant arguments I was having. I wondered sometimes why it was that I did not believe what they were saying. I also questioned how and why I did not believe them. Sometimes I would doubt even myself. Other times they had a half-truth, and I would dwell on it. But always by morning I knew that they had it wrong. Some of these arguments were with well-educated adults, and I was only a teenager. How could I not believe them? I was known eventually as a fighting cock, or a kafirbuti, which meant black sister or brother. The derogatory term emphasizing the insult. But to me it was an honor. It symbolized my brotherhood with humanity. This song was very popular in my teenage years. I remember my Afrikaans buddy singing it, blissfully unaware of its meaning. And then the AW people realized what it meant, and they quickly banned it. But the English National Rail Airways, like 702, would play it in defiance to the separatist group. The song I am talking about is by an Australian band called Midnight Oil, and the line in the song says, "The time has come to say fair's fair, to pay the rent, to pay our share. It belongs to them, let's give it back." And that infuriated my friends when I used to play it. Here is Midnight Oil.
Out where the river broke, the bloodwood and the desert oak.
You need to know that by the time I was born, Mandela was already captured, sentenced, and had already spent a number of years in prison. His wife, Winnie Madikiza Mandela, was running his campaign, and she had transformed from a humble, shy maid that Nelson had married into a vicious, relentless, and blindly passionate antagonist. I also need to tell you that not all the Afrikaans AWB members were cruel. I remember a group of whites organizing a fundraiser to build a school in Joburton, which was our local shanty town. Do you know that apartheid means separation and that all the people were divided up according to their race? We grew up English in an Afrikaans city. We were also treated and bullied by some Afrikaans groups for being rooinekke, which means rednecks. But when that would happen, my dad would tell us to toughen up and not to show them how much it affected us. He would always tell us about the blind whip and to remember that God did not sleep. If we took revenge upon ourselves, he would say, then the shame would be on us, and it would be short-lived. But if we left it to God, it could be everlasting. Even if it meant waiting till we were old, we would see the punishment God would inflict on them. And do you know what? I have lived to see my bullies face the blind whip. There were around our city areas for coloreds, Indians, blacks, and then we whites had areas too. To be honest, the land we whites occupied was vast, while we stuck the other non-white areas on the outskirts. The non-whites were only allowed into our territory to work, or some Indians had shops in special Indian quarters. By the height of the conflict, the non-whites had to be out of the white areas by 7 p.m., and if anyone was caught outside the curfew without papers, they would be beaten by vigilante groups or arrested and flogged by the police. My dad's house was a known safe haven, and he would give safety to many a black person. As I was saying, not all whites were cruel, they did believe that the races were to be separated for safety as well as cultural purity. A lot of them, especially the ones I argued with, believed that the black Khoisas should not intermarry with the Zulus, for instance, as this would also degrade the black races. The Portuguese in our city were not allowed to marry Afrikaans girls either. And because of keeping the line pure, some extremists were still hung up on the Anglo-Boer War and believed that even to marry an English person was abominable. But that was only the extremist. Not everyone was that bad. My earliest memory of being brainwashed was by my science teacher, but I'm not going to tell you what he said. I will tell you about another incident. When my parents were involved with our local church in raising money to build a high school in our black shanty called Joburton, we call the shantytown a location. It took them 2 years and several fundraisers and a lot of bullying from white supremacists to raise enough money. But they made it, and when they were almost finished with the building, the builders were stoned, their vehicles overturned, equipment stolen, and the building was set alight. Please note that some of those killed were black people. I cannot remember how many of my parents' friends were wounded or killed, but I do remember that when my dad read the news in the paper, he went red-faced and kept shouting at our garden boy, telling him what barbarians they were. Poor Sydney was our old garden boy, and he wouldn't even hurt a fly, but my dad was mad, and he chased him with a garden fork to his hut, which was a dark shed at the back of our garden. But my dad was actually not a cruel man. My parents taught us kindness, and they were involved in a lot of voluntary organizations. Before the conflict became too dangerous and risky, my parents would often let black people stay overnight in Sydney's dark hut if they had missed the curfew, and my mother helped many a pregnant black lady. But one time, my dad came inside, white-faced. I don't know what happened, but he stopped helping anyone after that. This is a song from the musical Serafina about the Soweto uprising during that time and one schoolgirl's courage. In 1986, I was in my first year in high school. My mother had passed away, and the world outside her house was dangerous. Most white houses were beginning to look like jailhouses, with burglar bars on all windows and gates being built around the entrances. The Soweto uprising had spread all across to our city, hundreds of kilometers away. There were lots of violent clashes with police, and we were conditioned in school even more about how terrible the black man was. We were afraid to walk to school. And even if we saw black people, we would cross the road to the other side. During that time, a young white musician stuck his neck out and joined forces with other black musicians, calling themselves Johnny Clegg and Savuka. And here was a white man speaking Zulu and crying out for freedom. The AWB hated him. But my sister had been sent a tape from London, and we were exposed for the first time to someone else's opinion. Here is Johnny Clegg and his band playing years later in a concert for Mandela's birthday.
In 1986, South Africa was in a state of emergency, and it was a very intense cultural struggle that was being waged. And we were part of that, and this is a song that we wrote for truly one of the greatest South Africans in history, Nelson Mandela, and we'd like to open the show tonight with a tribute to him.
Selikuna,
I used to think South Africa would never change and that apartheid would be there forever. But years passed by, and when I was in my final years at school, lo and behold, a miracle happened. Nelson Mandela was released. Right, and jump a few years further, I was still arguing with Afrikaners, but gave up hope of ever making a difference to their opinion. It was irreversible to that generation. Mandela was in power, and he was spreading peace, but the grassroots did not see a difference. Crime increased drastically as poverty stayed the same. Our community lived in fear that the black people would attack them any minute. They gathered guns and made plans of counterattack should a civil war break out. They did all sorts of sums declaring why Mandela was the Antichrist, 666. And to top their fears, the new government was awarded the host of the World Rugby Tournament. Adding insult to injury, the new powers wanted to remove their symbol of Springbok colors. And their national flag had been changed in time for the World Cup. The AWB hated the new flag colors and displayed the old flag in defiance. And I tell you honestly that I was disappointed with the movie Invictus because I felt it would have had a better impact if they had showed more of the Afrikaans antagonism and level of fear. Were the movie researchers, were they truly oblivious to the real threat of bombings? This is how I experienced it. My boss at the time was a horrible racist, and I hated the way he treated our black customers, even though it was illegal. I was scared of him, but I was still trying to make up for his brutality by being extra friendly to the black customers. He loved rugby, and so I was surprised that he showed no interest in buying tickets to the World Cup, even though he was constantly talking about it. He was rich enough to afford the tickets. The office I worked in overlooked his pool, so I knew his living conditions and his family life well. On the opening night of the World Cup, he even organized a party at his house to watch the big match, and I remember him constantly asking for his thick black cell phone. He hardly ever answered it and never cared much for the cumbersome piece, so I thought he just wanted to brag with it. He was unusually happy and friendly that historical day. He let me off early to join the celebrations. At one point, the camera zoomed into Mandela as he waved, and the camera panned onto him wearing not one of his famous loud shirts, but the controversial green and gold Springbok colors. And the house I was in went silent, everybody looking at my boss. Time stood still for a moment, and all you could hear was the deafening roar from the TV as the crowds on the stadium whistled and cheered. My boss, who I dare not mention on air today, recovered and went straight for the cell phone, dialing frantically and jumping uneasily as he waited for the other side to pick up. Stop dialing, no, hardloop! And his exact words I cannot remember, but translated it meant, stop that thing now, run! I remember hearing the words bomb, but I cannot be sure. I just remember the relief on the face of his friends in the room as they clapped and cheered and jumped up and down, shouting, Mandela for president! And that was the day my boss's attitude changed. He became less aggressive towards the blacks and even invited some of his best customers over for a South African braai. That's a barbecue. He still was angry a lot, but at least he started showing respect to the black businessmen. And Mandela was forevermore to be called Madiba by both black and whites. And if one simple act can change my boss and those in that room, then Mandela is my hero. After that day, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission revealed all sorts of atrocities from my friends had committed. I felt strong repulsion for my fellow Afrikaner. I needed to get out of that town. But that's another story. Today, I want you to pay tribute to all Africans, black, white, colored, Indian, and especially to all my fellow Africans scattered across the globe. Yari is a song by that courageous white man, Johnny Clegg, whom I played for you earlier. Ironically, he was singing about the black men that had to flee the country. Now, nearly 30 years onwards, I refer to the whites who are fleeing. The blind whip, my friends, the blind whip. Now, I don't have much time left, but I have to sail all the way from Southern Africa up the western side of the African continent and stop a moment in the land of Nigeria. Let's not forget that a lot of African people still have a long way to walk for the reality of freedom. Today, a very dear friend of mine made that walk to freedom all the way from Nigeria, and she has been living in Ireland for a long time. She hopes to host a few workshops in Westport. Let's listen to her and let's support her in her efforts to teach us African skills. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning.
Welcome to Wired Willow.
Well, thanks for having me.
Annie, you're obviously not a Covey.
No, I'm not a Covey.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Nigeria.
But you
in West Africa.
Yeah, that's a beautiful country. What brought you to Westport?
Well, actually, I came to Ireland as an asylum seeker in year 2000. And we were taken to Clifden. And from Clifden, my husband got some friends from Westport, and they became friends. And eventually, he came to visit for one day, and he liked it. And we eventually moved to Westport.
How long have you been living in Westport?
Almost 15 years now.
15 years? So, and you got a son. How old is your
son?
He's
14.
He's 14. He's a wonderful
Thanks.
Boy. He's a gifted boy, that boy.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're living in Westport, and you're quite well associated. People will know you because you've done a few workshops before,
haven't
you?
Yeah, I did some workshop for the art festival in Westport in year 2000 and in year 2001. I also did one in Louisburg as well.
Now, people are listening and wondering what it is exactly you do, and it is you are a fashion designer by trade.
Yeah, I'm a fashion designer by profession, and I also do batik and tie and dye workshop.
And that's what you're doing this. You're hosting a series of workshops soon.
Yes, we are hosting a series of workshops. The first one will be started by the 19th of July at the Austin O'Malley at their living room cafe. So we are hosting it there in Castle Bar Road.
Now, what does it entail? It's batik.
Batik and tie and dye.
Well, what is batik?
Batik is an African way of printing into fabric and actually redyeing the fabric. You use wax to print the designs, and then you dye it. And also, tie and dye is also another method we use in the ancient African way of dyeing clothes, which is by folding or by sewing or needle designs on the fabric, and then you deep dye them.
Okay, so that's very interesting. It's not the way I always thought, because my traditional way is you tie elastic bands and then you just put it in an open
box.
And it's usually unsuccessful.
But you know, in African country, it has been a tradition for a very long time. We have different methods of how you actually put prints on fabric. So in different African countries have their own different ways of doing it.
Okay, and you are going to teach us the Nigerian way.
Yes, I'm going to teach you the West African way.
And these workshops are really reasonable. I know they should look out for them. So where can someone look out for them? Where will they be advertised? In Super
in
Value?
In Super Value, in Centra, and in the library.
Okay, well, they should be keep a lookout as well as listening to Westport Radio, and we'll keep you informed. Now, the workshops you do, is it one-day workshops, two-day workshops?
The Tie and Dye workshop is a one-day workshop. But we are also going to be having a fashion workshop, which will be an 8-week workshop. And after the 8 weeks, you have 1 week to actually do your own creation from scratch. And then we will have a fashion show on the 10th week.
Okay, that sounds really fabulous. And you will be making it. Now, I just have to know, do we have to bring all our own materials to this?
Well, for the tie and dye workshop, everything will be provided for you. For the workshop for the day, which includes all the dye and all the fabrics you are going to be using for the tie and dye workshop. But for the fashion workshop, you only need to bring your tape roll and some paper, and
which you will be telling.
Yeah, we'll be giving more information to people about what they need to bring.
Okay, so could you give us your telephone number, please, how we could get hold of you?
My name is Annie, and the surname is Oladele, and it's 087-299-7280.
Could you repeat that for
us, please? It's 087-299-7280.
And if anyone is interested, they could contact the studio. Yes. We will have it inside for you. Annie, I want to thank you for coming on board. And it's really a pleasure. You're such a gifted woman and so blessed. And I've seen some of your work. You're such a stylish woman. And you rather keep a low profile around Westport, but you've always got a smile on your face. And you're always very friendly.
Thank you very much for your good
and
word.
And helpful. You're extremely helpful.
Thanks a lot for your good word.
Now, I know that the course that you're hosting today, as we speak, happening out at Living, was probably coming to a conclusion now. The people are probably soaked in tie-dye themselves. So do you advise them to wear old clothes when they come to the workshops?
Yes, hopefully maybe wear something old, but we're going to try as much as possible to not get the dye on you anyway.
So you're going to teach us how to do it, how to work, not like
children.
Yeah,
that's true.
Okay, well, we look forward to listening up for the workshops, and I'm going to have you, hopefully you'd come on and tell us a bit more about your story. I'd love to hear
okay,
from you.
Okay, definitely we'd like to do that.
Thank you for
Thank
your
you
time.
Thank you very much
Annie.
For having me.
Bye.
Leso leso kuma ilo kuma sakule kumerewe kama saka eriko kuma roke kumerewe kama chide dareko lero se kama siule omate mwiko kama awo dupe oma woshi
with Me and My Broken Heart, requested by Connor on Facebook. And welcome back to the
Tune Sound Wave Show.
Yeah.
Woo!
I'm Grani Fahi.
And I'm Bernice Borman back.
Okay, be sure to like our Facebook page and tweet us and email us. We're going to be back after this next song. We're going to be back after this next song with a special guest. This song is Glorious by Foxes. Welcome back to the True Soundwave Show. We are here with a very, very important guest. Welcome Mark Tobin, my cousin.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're good, thank you. How are you?
Good, now good.
That's good.
Can you hear me? Hi.
Yes.
Your first question is, what are your inspirations?
I suppose a lot of my inspirations came from the likes of Red Hot Chili Peppers, Soft Oil, Codeline of today, enough, but I suppose all people like that. And I'm very interested in Paul Weller and different, you know, there's a very wide variety of music that I'm into. So I couldn't really pick one in particular now.
Okay, then how about your favourite artist? What kind of bands do you like?
My favourite artist at the minute would have to be Codeline. Other than that, all along, Snowfall has been by far my most favourite band, definitely.
Okay, and what would you say is your most bizarre hobby?
God, you had me caught in this one. I really don't know, to be honest. I don't actually think I have any bizarre hobbies, really. Other people might say different, but I genuinely don't think I do.
Okay, what's your first concert? Can you tell us a bit about your first concert?
My first concert was Stereophonics. They were playing in Slane Castle. I was 16, I think, and it just blew me away. It just totally put a different perspective on. I used to be just listening to music at home, but since then I've always been able to go to different gigs and different concerts and things like that. And I suppose it's helped me as well, I said, like with my music, you know, just seeing big bands up there the way they are and just kind of dreaming that, yeah, maybe someday you'll get that far, but they were very, very good.
And what would you say, when was your first live performance and how did it go?
God, you have me on this one. I think my first live performance was, I used to play in the local church choir, and it was an experience. It was very daunting, you know, you were sitting up there at the front of the church.
Quite a religious experience.
Yeah, very, very religious experience. But no, it was good fun, and it brought my confidence on an awful lot as well, I suppose, with playing the guitar and singing.
Can you tell us a bit about the craziest thing that has ever happened to you on stage?
It's actually really been very quiet. I suppose the craziest thing that I've been involved with really on stage was we were playing a gig one night, and during the middle of a song, our drummer fell off his chair, the legs broke in his chair, and he fell back, and all the drums just went everywhere. It was just a big loud crash, and it was very entertaining now at the time. not for him, it was for us.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and here's a little, weird curveball question. Would you rather be forced into the Hunger Games or Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
Oh, God. Can I say neither? if we had to, we'd have to say the Kardashians, I suppose.
I think they do the same thing.
Yeah. I'd prefer not to go into any of them, to be honest.
What's your most awkward moment in life?
I suppose the most awkward moment in life to date had been when I was younger. I was in Waterford chatting with my grandmother, and we were going up along an escalator, and I didn't realise, I was about maybe 4 or 5, I didn't realise my laces were up, and my laces got caught in the top of the escalator.
Oh no,
that
happened
and to I you. Fell, and I fell over.
Oh no.
Thank God I have no bruises or scars in much of it.
Okay, if you could collaborate with any artist in the world, who would it be?
Oh, that's an easy one, definitely. It would have to be Gary Lightbody from Snowfall. Just seeing the work that he's done with different artists.
Are you jealous of Taylor Swift?
Not really. I'm jealous of Gary Lightbody for doing a song with Taylor Swift, okay?
Yeah.
But no, definitely Gary Lightbody. He's brilliant. All his songs are very, very good. And I suppose if we were to bring it back to a local scale or an Irish scale, Gavin James, he's just an amazing talent. He's very, very good.
There's quite a lot of talent out there. Can you give a message to all young musicians out there?
I suppose just be yourself, keep singing or playing whatever you like to play. And
make sure the chairs on. Make sure the legs on your chairs don't break.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I suppose going back to that question as well. I suppose an embarrassing moment for me was we were playing a gig one night and the strap on my guitar gave way, and my guitar fell.
Oh no!
Fell and hit off the ground. I think I had my new guitar. I'd say about 3 weeks at the time.
I broke my guitar in a terrible busking accident.
Oh no! There's nothing worse. It's like an extra arm.
Yeah.
But I suppose. Just basically, I'd be saying to anyone, just keep doing it. There's always going to be people who knock you for different things, and you're always going to hear people saying, oh, this person is no good. But, you know, like, if you keep doing it and you're having fun, I'd say definitely stick at it.
That's no the smartest thing you've ever said in the entire time I've known you, Mark.
Sorry?
It's the only wise thing I've ever heard you say in the entire time I've been here.
I hope you have it recorded, because I probably won't ever say anything sexual ever again.
It'll be up on podcast. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us today.
Would you like to give
any shout-outs to anyone?
I suppose just like to give a shout-out to all the lads in the band. We're actually down here at the minute setting up for a gig we have later on tonight. I suppose Dahi.
And will you be performing in the Mayo area anytime soon?
Well, hopefully. That's up to you to try and get us some gigs up there.
We'll see what we can do.
We're more than willing to travel if you're more than willing to get us the gigs.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking to us today. Ladies
Thanks
and gentlemen, listening to the Tune Sandwich Show, Mark Tobin.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we're going to play a song by Tom Waits. This is Underground. This is time to conclude our rather short episode of the Truant Soundwave Show. Thanks to Holly for having us on. And I also want to give a huge thank you to whoever voted me in the Young Guns competition. And it was such a huge shock to like get the phone call and being told I won. It was probably the biggest shock I've ever gotten.
And congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you.
Winning it.
Yes, please, do you have any last words to say?
Not really, but actually I do. I missed the last two episodes because I was at a way.
Only last one episode.
Or one last episode. Because I was at a way camping in Tipperary. The weather was okay, but it was great fun. It was a wonderful holiday.
Shout out to whoever was at the camp.
Yeah, at the camp.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to be interviewing someone called Stuart over there who I can't wait to be interviewing when he gets back.
Okay, so tune in next week to hear more from us. And we're going to close the song with a song by a really great musician who did everything on this song himself, produced it, played every instrument, wrote the lyrics. This is Patrick Stump with Cryptozoology.